Welcome to the 9th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a new podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These are premier and renowned meetings that educate community-based oncologists and healthcare professionals on novel treatment approaches for patients with cancer. The summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. In Onc Live On Air, you can expect to hear from academic oncologists on the thought-provoking presentations they give at these meetings. The topics vary from systemic therapies, surgery, radiation therapy, to emerging therapeutic approaches in a particular disease. That brings us to today's episode. On September 13th, we traveled to Dearborn, Michigan for a State of the Science Summit on Hematologic Malignancies with faculty of Karmanos Cancer Institute. The meeting covered updates and emerging treatment approaches in newly diagnosed and relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, Hodgkin lymphoma, T-cell lymphoma, acute myeloid leukemia, chronic myeloid leukemia, myelodysplastic syndrome, CAR T-cell therapy, and chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Multiple myeloma has a treatment paradigm that is consistently emerging with new agents and combinatorial approaches. Beyond induction therapy, researchers have been looking at ways to bring monoclonal antibodies, proteasome inhibitors, immunomodulatory agents, and more into earlier lines of therapy. Moreover, stem cell transplantation remains to be a staple in the landscape, but how will that role evolve as time goes on? Our chair of this meeting, Jeffrey Zonder, MD, a hematologist at Karmanos Cancer Institute, sat down with Onc Live to discuss the standard approaches to first-line treatment and how recent clinical trial data are leading to the investigation of more combination regimens, such as with monoclonal antibodies like daratumumab.
I think we're exploring optimal induction. We're looking at best-in-class IMIDs and proteasome inhibitors as part of the induction regimen. But I think monoclonal antibodies are really the unanswered question right now. But as I'll discuss tonight, we have some early hints that adding monoclonal antibodies to induction therapy can make a really big difference. I think a lot of different regimens are going to be explored, but I'll mention the Griffin study, which is an RVD Revlimid or lenalidomide bortezomib dexamethasone with or without daratumumab. That's a study that has accrued its patients, and we're waiting for the answer, but I suspect that study will have quite an impact on practice, particularly when you combine it with the data that you mentioned already. I think we're going to have a consistent story and a strong argument for incorporating antibodies early.
Meanwhile, the relapsed refractory space in myeloma continues to be a focus of research. Beyond the novel agents that are approved in this setting and are now being explored in upfront use, chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy with the BCMA-targeted product BB2121 has also shown potential in heavily pretreated patients. Additionally, though checkpoint inhibitors were held back in multiple myeloma trials due to significant toxicity issues and an increase in the relative risk of death, there could be ways to include this class of agents in this disease. Taking all of this into consideration, there is great work ahead regarding optimal sequencing of therapies, explained Andrew Kin, MD, an oncologist at Karmanos Cancer Institute. Here's what Kin had to say.
Myeloma has been kind of blessed and cursed to some extent in recent years that we've had so many new therapies available and so many new combinations of those therapies that, you know, I mentioned myeloma is also fortunate that all those agents synergize and work better together. So, you know, in the frontline setting, you're, you know, starting to get some clarity as to kind of a standard regimen and, you know, how can you apply that to a relapse setting when you've got so many different options available. You know, so kind of the key things to look at is, you know, to some extent, you know, maybe taboo at a State of the Science summit, but there is an art of the medicine involved in kind of picking and choosing, individualizing the therapy for your patient. You want to look at a few key things of, specifics of their disease. How quickly is it coming back? Is it just a biochemical, detesting it, or a loss of MRD in some cases where they're testing that? Or is it an aggressive kind of symptomatic relapse with a new fracture? You need to know, what prior treatments they have been on with so many therapies that, and so many classes of medications available now that you're using new classes of therapy. And then the patient side of things, do they have any specific comorbidities, or do they have any prior toxicities with prior therapy that would kind of influence you towards or away from any particular agent or combination? With that kind of in mind, there's a couple generalizations that we are able to make, is that almost all of the trials in the relapse setting have been a comparison of three drugs versus two drugs, adding either to a backbone of Revlimid and dexamethasone or lenalidomide, and or bortezomib and dexamethasone. And across the board, they all showed improvement, three drug versus a two drug strategy. So again, if your patient is fit enough and doesn't have any toxicities, that I think it's pretty clear that a three-drug combination in the relapse setting is what you should be shooting for. With that said, if you don't have any specific contraindications, the data with daratumumab in combination with lenalidomide and bortezomib, either one, has been very impressive in terms of both depth of response, duration of response, and kind of the potential with daratumumab to kind of de-escalate and turn into a second maintenance phase, basically. So kind of for those reasons, I tend to prefer that in combination with the agent. They were not used on their previous maintenance therapy as the first relapse setting. And in the second line, there's a number of options available that are all very great therapy. Carfilzomib or pomalidomide-based regimens, again, triplet if possible, would be preferred. The one trial, and specifically highlighted tonight, that was presented recently at the EHA conference has the ELOQUENT 3 data with ilituzumab in combination with and compared to pomalidomide and dexamethasone, that showed really pretty impressive hazard ratio and progression-free survival. Like other antibody therapies, it was pretty well tolerated, didn't have a lot of in the way of infusion reactions, so really lends itself well to combination and triplet therapy.
The treatment landscapes of Hodgkin lymphoma and T-cell lymphoma continued to build with interesting data, specifically with the Echelon 1 study, in which patients with advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma saw a 23% risk reduction in progression, death, or need for additional therapy with the use of brentuximab vedotin plus doxorubicin, vinblastine, and dacarbazine as frontline therapy. Immunotherapy also made an impact in this area with the 2016 FDA approval of nivolumab for the treatment of patients with classical Hodgkin lymphoma that has relapsed or progressed after autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and post-transplantation brentuximab vedotin. Rod Ramchandran, MD, an oncologist at Karmanos Cancer Institute, laid out the recent advances in both the Hodgkin lymphoma and T-cell lymphoma fields.
Hodgkin's lymphoma is a disease that occurs in generally young individuals. It has been a landmark condition because we have had early success through history in treating it. However, this has come at the cost of toxicities, both acute and long-term, for patients who survive. And there are patients who unfortunately don't respond to standard chemotherapy and radiation, relapse, and for those patients, autologous stem cell transplant is an option. However, some of those patients can't achieve a remission and go to transplant, or are unable to go to transplant for other reasons. And for those individuals, expectations are very short in terms of lifespan and quality of life. There have been new drugs that have been developed over the course of the last decade in Hodgkin's lymphoma, which have been really groundbreaking in terms of their mechanism of action and activity, and they have been evaluated in earlier and earlier lines of therapy and in combination with chemotherapy. And most recently, the Echelon 1 data incorporated brentuximab vedotin plus ABD versus the standard therapy with ABVD in advanced stage disease. And it showed a benefit in modified progression-free survival, which is one of the first, if any, studies incorporating a novel agent to a chemotherapy backbone in Hodgkin's lymphoma showing this benefit. Secondarily, checkpoint inhibitors have shown significant activity as well in the relapse setting and are currently being evaluated in the frontline setting. And now multiple studies are also evaluating this in the frontline setting for Hodgkin's lymphoma. So it's a very exciting time.
A number of FDA approvals have occurred in acute myeloid leukemia over the past 1.5 years, which have improved outcomes for patients. But there needs to be a greater focus on biomarker work and identifying therapies for the more than 70 molecular targets, according to Jay Yang, MD, a member of the Malignant Hematology Multidisciplinary Team at Karmanos Cancer Institute. Yang discusses the emergence of FLT3 and IDH1 and 2 inhibitors and more that are moving through the pipeline. However, there are still challenges ongoing that he hopes to overcome in the near future.
Well, there's a large number of mutations that are found in AML. There's more than 70 recurrently mutated genes found in the AML genome. All of these could potentially be targets for drug therapy. However, only a few of them so far we've been successful. The main ones are FLT3, and it comes in two forms, the FLT3 TKD mutation and the FLT3 ITD mutation. And also there's an IDH2 mutation and an IDH1 mutation. And as of now, all three of those are targetable. There's a lot of challenges. Despite all the drug approvals, there's still a lot of challenges. I think the drugs that, or at least in terms of targeted agents targeting molecular mutations, perhaps the FLT3 inhibitors and the IDH2 inhibitors and IDH1 inhibitors, maybe you could consider them the lowest hanging fruit in a way, because these were common mutations and they were able to rapidly develop drugs that specifically target those mutations. I think going forward, the sledding is going to be a little bit tougher. There's a lot of mutations out there, but AML is a very tricky and difficult disease to treat. And just because you have a drug that can target a mutation doesn't mean that it's going to be effective. And so there are pathways, there are mutations, there are drugs in the pipeline, but it may be a little bit more difficult in the future going forward finding that next drug.
Ihab Atala, MD, an associate professor of medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, said that survival outcomes for patients with chronic myeloid leukemia are similar to the general population. However, that doesn't mean that all research work is said and done. While TKIs such as nilotinib and imatinib have been associated with impressive results, patient report quality of life issues remain on these therapies long term. Therefore, Atala spoke to the pivotal studies exploring TKI discontinuation and the significant need to still develop novel agents for this population. Here's what Atala shared with us.
What was found that, going back to 2010, the very first study, there were patients who stopped their drug, a carefully selected group of patients who are in a deep remission, doing really well. They stopped their drug, and only half of them needed to restart their drug. Based on that study, there have been multiple studies across the world and have enrolled more than 2,000 patients, and now we know that this approach is safe for a select group of patients. One of the studies that was done recently is the ENEST stop trial, And that trial, what's different about it than all the other trials is it enrolled patients who were resistant to imatinib or were on imatinib before and then switched to nilotinib. So not all patients were resistant to imatinib. Some of them were physician choice or were intolerant to imatinib and then switched to nilotinib. And then got nilotinib, and once they were in a sustained deep molecular response, they stopped the nilotinib. And the rates of successful TFR or treatment free remission is about 50%, so very similar to other studies for stopping TKIs in the frontline setting. So the criteria for stopping now are very clear in the NCCN guidelines, and that is based on all these studies that I talked about earlier. So patients have to be in a chronic phase CML, so not an advanced phase. They have to be on drug for at least 3 years, have to have a sustained deep molecular response, and essentially what that means is that their PCR level is really low, which at least 4 log reduction for at least 2 years. They also have to be compliant patients, which means patients that are willing, after they stop their drug, to come in every month to get their lab checked at least for 6 months, and then every 2 months for 18 months, and then monthly thereafter. So you have to have a compliant patient in the chronic phase who is in a deep remission, and these are the patients you would consider for stopping. Having said that, the patient criteria, we also have physician criteria. So the physician or the health care should be ready to take care of those patients. It sounds simple, but really to monitor patients after they stop, they have to be monitored closely. These results have to be followed. So you really need a good group of healthcare providers that are willing to care for those patients.
Myelodysplastic syndrome continues to be a disease generally found in an elderly population, said Joseph Uberti, MD, PhD, Division Chief of Hematology, and co-director of the Bone Marrow Transplant Program at Karmanos Cancer Institute. Yet, he explained that despite some misconceptions, elderly patients are eligible for transplantation as a curative strategy for their MDS. He added that clinicians should consider a number of factors to determine whether or not a patient is fit enough to undergo transplant, but the approach remains a standard in the MDS paradigm. Nevertheless, there is work ongoing to develop other treatment approaches for transplant-ineligible patients and other subgroups. Here's what Uberti had to say.
So I think there are a number of reasons patients don't, or referring physicians don't use transplants as much for MDS. Age is certainly one of the things. I think people have the misperception that older patients can't make it through transplant easily. And I'll show data tonight showing that really they can do just as well as younger patients. I think the other perception is that we can't find donors for our patients. Now we have new donors available for our patients that really allows us to find donors for almost everybody who needs a transplant. So that has changed the ability to do transplants in many patients that we couldn't transplant before, because we have new ways to find donors for them that are very effective and they can be transplanted with equal efficacy as if they had a brother or sister as a donor. One of the problems with MDS is that it's the age of older patients. So older patients acquire all the comorbidities we all do as we age. They have heart problems, lung problems, kidney problems, but even in certain patient populations, even with those, we can get them through a transplant.
Among the numerous exciting advances in hematologic malignancies, CAR T-cell therapy stands out as a novel option, not just in lymphomas, but it's beginning to cross into other blood cancers such as multiple myeloma. Between tisagenlecleucel and axicabtagene siloleucel and others moving through clinical development, Abhinav Deel, MD, an oncologist at Karmanos Cancer Institute, said it is exciting to see the progress being made thus far. However, he says, challenges do exist. This includes managing adverse events such as cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity, but it also includes financial challenges. Deel shared his thoughts on the CAR T-cell therapy evolution.
So the most important thing that we worry about these patients, not only do they have the associated chemotherapy because chemotherapy side effects, because they do get some low-dose chemotherapy prior to getting CAR T-cells, so nausea, vomiting, hair loss can be seen. But the unique side effects that we've recognized with CAR T-cells is things like cytokine release syndrome and neurological toxicity. So the cytokine release syndrome can be, in some mild cases, just be characterized by some fevers, chills, patients having slightly low blood pressure that responds to IV fluids, to the and in other extreme cases, patients can have fevers that are very, very high, blood pressure that drops low enough that they might require medications to help support their blood pressure. In terms of neurological toxicity, some patients don't have any neurological toxicities. Other patients might have mild confusion. And again, in the severe extreme, patients can become comatose or have seizures as a result of neurotoxicity. And so far, the approval from the FDA, the companies have been very, very careful in terms of having sites that have had experience and the adequate training to treat patients with this. And they're limiting it in the first rollout to the sites that are able to manage these toxicities, because it is a multimodality management, including ICU neurology, that needs to be involved in management of these patients.
Finally, we visited with Arlene Seymour, MD, a member of the hematology-oncology multidisciplinary team at Karmanos Cancer Institute, about the updates in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Current therapy options beyond chemoimmunotherapy are available, such as the BTK inhibitor ibrutinib, PI3K delta inhibitor etolalisib, and the BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax. However, Seymour said there is room for more options and other agents are in development, including the BTK inhibitor acalabrutinib, the PI3K delta and gamma inhibitor duvelisib, and combination approaches of ibrutinib and venetoclax, as well as ibrutinib plus fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, and rituximab.
Some of the more promising data, which was presented at ASH of last year and some at ASCO this year, is in combination with venetoclax. There's also a trial looking at in combination with obinutuzumab, venetoclax, and ibrutinib. That is in a 14-month course, so you know, shorter than some other courses that are out there. And that the results of that phase one trial has already been published. And so I think certainly in combination with venetoclax, probably also in combination with obinutuzumab. The nice thing about those combinations with venetoclax is we're seeing less tumor lysis syndrome when we do this. And so I think all of those trials, there's multiple in combination, are going to give us a little bit more direction on how to go, what the next step will be.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 9th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit OncLive.com, sign up for our e-newsletters, and check out OncLive.com/State of the Science Summit to sign up for a meeting in a city near you. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. That's all for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air.